Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually The Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against the wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. Pivoting into a creative field and is really ready to see what they can produce out of it, that is always cause for celebration on this show. And my guest this week is absolutely no exception to that. Dale Walsh has been producing verse consistently ever since he graduated in 1985. He's gotten as much as 5,000 works or even more of various poems that are available on Amazon. And at the same time, he has also been a financial advisor for World Financial Group. And he's also currently, and for quite a while, a mentor for families that are dealing with loved ones that have serious mental illness. So he has been basically doing his part to assist the family members to try to get through those serious issues. At the same time, he is also working to go full time as a creative and a poet. He has 6 unpublished manuscripts, and he also has a memoir about his great quote unquote psychotic break at Dartmouth College in 1975 that's called Escape from the Ivy League. And he has a lot of very unique insight for all the different things that we as creatives deal with. So this is definitely going to be an incredibly useful conversation for all of you who are dealing with various elements that go into being a creative, things with anxiety, depression, and all the different things that keep us from moving forward mentally. Dale is definitely no exception to that and can provide a lot of unique insight. And I'm really excited for this conversation. So without further ado, please let me welcome my guest this week, Dale Walsh. Dale, how are you, sir?
Very well, George. Thank you very much for such a glowing introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
As am I, sir, as am I. And I understand that you have a couple of poems that you use to kind of get the conversation started.
That's correct. So the one I usually use is called Dale Reviewing What Actually Happened. And Dale actually is a poetic form that I came up with. It's 6 words a line, 2 sets of 9 rhymes a piece. So, you know, people say, what's that mean? So I just give an example, and this is one of the 2. It goes, reviewing what actually happened. Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm God was a joke I made after Killer Dartmouth Doak of some primo Ivy League smoke, which apparently caused me to croak because it meant the hospital I awoke with Rumi Gabriel, the main bloke who did my delusions angelically stroke. Even while the doctor claimed my brain broke, the moment divine gag I spoke, testifying I was only big quack, which clinicians diagnosed as psychotic attack, preventing me from getting sanity back until I came to Teaneck Hackensack to pursue resident therapy program track and deal with my evident lack of reason among psychiatric patient pack who never gave me any slack. Under interrogation, the story didn't crack.
That is fabulous. That is a news on the march take. It's almost like the beginning of Citizen Kane, the whole like news on the march reel where we go into like the general elements of Charles Foster Kane and then we go into the specifics. So that is, I can't think of a better way to start this conversation.
Well, I appreciate it. So it's all based on reality. What happened was I had an excellent secondary education. So I got to Dartmouth College. I had a very successful academic, but also drug-infested freshman year. I was smoking like high-powered Ivy League marijuana every day and taking other things like LSD and mescaline and other hallucinogenics and everything. So, but I also had like a B plus A minus average in upper-level courses as a freshman. So what happened was in the summer after my freshman year, it all caught up with me. I mean, everything, you know, basically caught up with me. And I came up with what I thought was a great joke, which was, "Hi, I'm God," because, and the punchline being, "How can God be 5'8"? You know, so I was like walking around campus telling everybody my joke. And because I thought it was so hysterical, I did this for about 2 days. About the third day, the campus cops came in, and I'm lighting a bowl of hash, and they say, "Are you Dale?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Would you come with us?" I said, "Sure." I thought they were going to take me to meet the president of the university, but instead, they took me to the infirmary, and for the next 4 hours, I was interrogated by 3 sets of Ivy League psychiatrists. My parents were out of town, so basically, they put me in a room and kept me in the infirmary for 2 days. Then they got 2 fraternity guys to drive me back home to New York City to my parents' house. Mm-hmm. And the next day, I was in a mental hospital in New York City for 13 weeks. And this led to 5 years in a private psychiatric program.
Wow. Wow. I can't even imagine going through that. I mean, that's got to be just really, really scary to be doing this, to be subjected to this while in school, while your parents are out of town. It was just like, there's nowhere else to go.
Well, I was living at Dartmouth. My father was becoming president of the American Bar Association.
Oh, wow.
That's why he was out of town. But, mm-hmm. So basically, you know, I don't know if you ever did LSD or read anything about LSD, but basically the idea of LSD is go with the flow.
Right. Like, so well, mine open your mind.
But also like go with the flow, you know, just see. So basically I went with the flow to see where this I'm God thing would take me. Mm-hmm. And it took me to a hospital, to a nice building in New York City where I met with the doctor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my parents were there and we were having a very nice conversation. I didn't mention anything about thinking I'm God or anything.
Right.
You know, we just had a very nice conversation. And so the doctor says, "Would you sign this deal?" And I said, "Sure." So I signed it and my parents got up, went left. I went left to follow them. Dr. Cohen, that's his name is Dr. Cohen. So upstairs for 13 weeks in a locked unit in a psychiatric hospital. And then because of how I got taken away from Dartmouth, Dartmouth said I had to take a year off. They wouldn't take me back at least for a year. So I wanted to go work sewer pipeline in Oklahoma, which I'd done the previous 2 summers. I lived with my grandmother and worked sewer pipelining. But my parents and the general consensus was I needed to be around peers and in some sort of psychiatric program. So
yeah.
My mother found this program under the direction of a single doctor for troubled adolescents and young adults. I went there. They told me I would be in Hackensack for 6 months, and it's been 50 years, George. Sometimes plans change. So the program, intensive therapy for 5 years, 3 individual sessions, 2 group sessions a week. Everybody ate together, and it was like a real like community and everything. But I also was hospitalized 9 times during my time in the program. And then I got out of the program. Got my own apartment, went back to school at Fairleigh Dickinson University, graduated magna cum laude in 1985, English, and then I sort of started an entrepreneurial career as a private tutor for Fairleigh Dickinson students who I would help write papers. And meanwhile, I was on disability, so I was only getting like $250 a month. So, and, you know, I was very fortunate that my parents could support me. You know, that's why I've never been homeless. I've never really had any troubles with the law or anything because I had my apartment. And I've been in the apartment for 44 years. And basically, I graduated, became a tutor, turned my focus to tutoring for about 10 semesters. And I also devoted myself to writing poetry as opposed to I'd written 6 books before I graduated. Mm-hmm. Then I turned my focus to poetry, and now I have 5,000 poems.
Wow. That's such an impressive output of work there. Now, you said that you had the six works before that, you know, like before you had graduated.
Right.
Were all of those prose? Were they nonfiction? Were they fiction?
I call them future fantasies because I say I'm an English major. I'm not a scientist. So they're future fantasies. But basically, I was very influenced by Star Wars, too. The books are like Star adventure, you know, Star Wars type adventures. It's also on Earth. It's my bestseller for last century, I call it, is Velvet Velour's Follies, book two, or The Flight of the Dialina, which is my spaceship. And that's basically an apocalyptic romance taking place in the shadow of the Cold War of the 80s.
Oh, and very cool. So it sounds like you got like a good mix of alternate history and science fiction and adventure
and self-reflection too.
Yeah, because it sounds like that was very therapeutic for you as well, which is always great. I love that's one great thing that I love about science fiction is how you can use science fiction to relay different current events about things that are going on.
Right.
You know, we didn't expect Planet of the Apes to be such a stark reflection on the social culture of its day.
Right.
So, you know, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant, you know, looking at it like that. And you can't help but not look at it like that. And then you have shows like the original Star Trek tackling various subjects along the way. And it's always fascinating. Like, what was it? The Invaders that Larry Cohen created, you know, that has aliens infiltrating the U.S. and it was like a take on communism. That's one thing I truly love about science fiction and how it helps you kind of tackle different subjects, but at the same time, without coming off as preachy, you're still able to tell a story.
To tell you the truth, I sort of like, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, I had my God delusions and everything. So basically I wrote my books, half gospel, half new gospel, and half future history.
Yeah.
And so,
very cool.
You know, and actually, Velvet Velour's Follies, The Flight of Dialina, it takes place in three different time zones. It's the 1980s, which is where Dale is and meets Lucy, who turns out to be Velvet.
Yep.
And then there's 2-2-2001, which is the last day of the world before the Ruski, the Russian, the Soviets, as I called them, attacked the United States with neutronic weapons to create the United States Museum. Do you know what a neutronic weapon is? A neutronic weapon is a bomb that kills people but doesn't destroy buildings.
So it wipes out living organisms.
I don't know how it works. And actually, you know, I always found that one of the ironies of neutronic bombs is you can't test them unless you don't kill your own people. I end the book with a 21 newt salute, which creates the United States Museum, which is the next book in the trilogy. But I love my books. I think it's part of my illness or I don't know, maybe not. But basically, I've just been very possessive of my books, of my novels and everything.
Totally with the sort of personal feelings that you obviously have for them. It sounds like they were there as a means of assistance for you to guide you through some really tough times. And it's like you owe it to him to keep them as is almost, right?
Right. Well, the other thing is that it was a way to fight the world war that was going on in my schizophrenic head.
Yeah. And I'm fascinated with the kind of weapon that's used because so many different stories, it's all about, you know, wiping out landmarks and, you know, this turning cities to rubble. And we're in this create like this post-apocalyptic sort of setup. But in this case, it's like the buildings are fine, but everyone else is gone. Like that's pretty wild.
Well, that's the whole thing, you know, and the ironic thing is I also have a concept called a concrete video, which is like where people are projected to be alive, but they aren't really there. So even though the neutron bombs are very effective and hit, everybody has been evacuated, although the Ruskies don't know because of concrete video.
Gotcha. Okay, so the concrete video is kind of keeping everything almost like a television image kind of thing.
Right.
Gotcha. Oh, that's fascinating. That's really cool. So it's like those that are surviving kind of use that as their own weapon against the Russians.
Right.
That's wild.
and it's a trilogy. And so, you know, I do plan on publishing them. But as for my poetry, as I said, I have 5,000 poems, but I only have 5 books on Amazon. But, you know, 5 books is still pretty significant. I haven't published anything since 2017. I have a new collection that I've had ready basically since Thanksgiving. I'm just waiting to find someone to do a cover for it. And then my new poetry book will be out.
Very cool. You already have the other poetry books. Do they already have covers?
Oh, yeah. They're all on Amazon.
Do they all have a specific type of cover? Were you working with different cover artists along the way, or?
I had 2 cover artists.
Okay.
5 books. One did 2 covers, the other one did 3.
Excellent. And now we have this latest one that just needs a cover art, and then number 6 would be able to come out.
And then I'll be able to get it on, out.
That's terrific. I am really impressed with that sort of production. And this is, you know, I'm speaking as someone who has been dealing with the same book since 2018. Just picking at this one book, which is, I should know exactly what I'm going to be saying because it's the last part of a trilogy. But at the same time, trilogies are the last part of a trilogy. Those are usually the toughest ones to make because you've got to stick the landing. You have to make sure that you stick the landing on that because too many people will say like, oh, wow, part one is really good. And then the second one is like, wow, the second one's even better. And then the third one, you know, you're ready to go ahead and land with both feet. And then all of a sudden you just twist an ankle and drop. So it's
right. I sort of like did a double take because the Velvet Velours trilogy is 3 books, but then, and one is basically a philosophical basis for Immaculate Conception. That's Velvet Velours Follies are the Lazy Man's Guide to Babies.
Nice.
And that's basically a scientific treatise. And then there's Flight of Dialina, which is like action. And then Last Leg to Ishkabob is like the adventure and basically sort of summarizes the story of Velvet and Truly Stylish, who's the commander of the Dialina. So, but then I wrote a sixth book, which is the day after Velvet and Truly have taken off on the Dialina.
Oh,
and
nice.
What's going on Earth and the war that's been initiated.
Oh, wow. Do you think that there's going to be some more stories that go in that direction?
I wrote a poem a day, every day from 1/1/23 to 3/20/25. So
that is wonderful. That is absolutely wonderful. And that's something that.
So basically, I feel it's time now to go back to prose. And this sort of gets into my schizophrenic thing. But basically, I feel that for the first time, I had a death experience in 1984. I had a vision where I saw the whole entire Earth being incinerated in a thermonuclear holocaust. And I called that the death of Dale. And that was September 26, 1984. Basically, it's been 40 years, and in that time, my alter ego basically took over my body, Dewey. I actually have 5 personalities, but Dewey took over for the last 40 years, but now Dale is back in Hackensack, and I spent the last 50 years of my life chasing the delusion that I'm God. And the question that comes up is, well, are you bitter? Do you think you wasted your life? And the answer to that is absolutely not. I can't think of anything better I could have been doing with my time.
There you go. In addition to what you've been doing with your time creatively, you've also been a big help for other families as a mentor to help them through certain situations. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. As I said before we came on, I feel that the family members of those with serious mental illnesses are forgotten victims of mental illness. Mm-hmm. I really feel, you know, that there's no way to prepare for a loved one getting serious. You know, I'll just talk about schizophrenia but there's no way to prepare for a loved one getting schizophrenia. There's very few ways to get information about the illness, and if someone is hospitalized, I'm sure you know about HIPAA, but basically HIPAA is laws that restrict the ability of families to contact their loved ones without the loved ones' written permission. That means that if you're 18 and get hospitalized, whether voluntarily or involuntarily, for a mental illness, then that means unless you give permission to the staff, your family can be completely in the dark about what you are, what's going on, what medication you're going. Even though a lot of families obviously have been involved with the care of their loved ones for a long time, but if they go to the hospital can change their meds or do whatever the hospitals do. But for instance, if your loved one is getting discharged on Saturday, if he doesn't give permission, then you're not even going to know that your son or daughter is out of the hospital.
Oh, man. And that's just going to create so many headaches right there.
Right. And yeah, I mean, this is just HIPAA. This is just the regulations of treatment. But there are just so many. And I just finished a 12-week advocacy boot camp with this organization called the Advocacy Center. And it was like 12 one-hour sessions, and it was just like so thorough and comprehensive about the questions and problems facing severely mentally ill people.
Yeah.
And it's just overwhelming. The system has absolutely no clue how to help people.
Right.
You know, and there's just like a impotence of power of ability to help people, you know. And the other thing is the criminalization of mental illness. You know, I mean, a lot of times people who should be, you know, they are building mental illness courts now, you know, and you can be directed towards those. But a lot of times, especially for like minor crimes, like minor theft or something, people will be criminalized because they're mentally ill. They'll be put in jail and they won't get treatment. And because they aren't getting treatment, they're just getting worse. I think this is accurate, but heard that California is the biggest California prison system is the biggest mental health system in the world. Because 70% of people in that system have some sort of serious mental illness.
And they're all incarcerated.
They're incarcerated for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they just are incarcerated because they can't get a competency test or they can't get into mental health court and stuff. I'll stop talking for a second. I don't know if there are any questions you want to ask me.
I am just like really kind of blown away by all of this, like everything that you do, everything that you have, that you've been able to provide for these families. Like that's really, it's very useful. It's incredibly useful. And it's something that I hope that if anyone out there who is listening, who is dealing with this, would they be able to reach out to you if they have further questions?
Sure. Well, the easiest way probably is I get free consultations. My website is www.dewlivelove.net.
Okay. So I'll put that in the show notes.
You can go there, but you can also make a 45-minute appointment with me at www.calendly.com/DaleCoach55.
Excellent.
But what I was saying is that another issue that's like a major focus, a major controversy right now is the issue of forced hospitalization.
Yeah.
You know, at what point does a person's inability to take care of themselves and to really like be safe within themselves become overdrawn by the need for that person to have self-sovereignty and basically, you know, self-integrity? And it is a very tricky point because, you know, a lot of people feel very strongly about this because if you are psychotic and you don't have the insight to know you're psychotic and you're a danger to yourself or to others, then that's basically the criteria that you have to have to get admitted to the hospital. But, you know, so many people are like slipping through the cracks because They like define danger to yourself and to others so strictly that a lot of people who really need help, they might not be homicidal or suicidal. They are in great suffering. They need help and they can't get into any treatment programs just because there are none, or because they're so overwhelmed, or because they aren't a danger to themselves or to others.
Yeah. So yeah, it sounds like everything that you can provide would just be absolutely useful for anyone who is dealing with things like this. So it sounds a lot like the writing that you do is almost like a coping mechanism to help you kind of work yourself through all of these different issues. Would you say that's correct?
To tell you the truth, George, I decided on my 10th birthday I was going to be a writer. On my 10th birthday, I decided I was going to be a writer. One of the ironies of my getting ill is that it's what got me out of the rat race so that I could dedicate myself to becoming the writer I wanted to become. As I said, my parents were very generous and they helped me and they supported me and everything. So that meant I didn't have to worry about paying rent and holding a job and everything. I wasn't writing, obviously, all the time.
Yeah.
The process of recovery itself is just, that was extremely challenging in a lot of ways. I was hospitalized 15 times. I got out 15 times. But when I was in the program, I was hospitalized 9 times for psychotic episodes. Wow. Basically, one thing that I wanted to talk about is, this is something I always bring up, but have you ever heard of the term agnosognosia?
No, I have not.
Okay, agnosognosia is a term taken from neurology for stroke victims who can't understand there's anything wrong with their brain.
So they can't even fathom the fact that something happened.
Right, exactly. But this term agnosognosia has been transferred to psychiatry.
Yeah.
And it's been found that in as much as 60 to 70% of people with serious severe mental illness have agnosognosia. So the analogy I use is, if you hold up a book in front of a blind person and say, read this, he's not going to be able to do this.
Right.
Agnosognosia is sort of the same thing for a person with mental illness. If you hold up his behavior and say, this is mentally ill, I'll agree. I don't comprehend that there's anything wrong with my brain. And so obviously this can be like a great, some people consider this the greatest obstacle to recovery. I was actually in agnosognosia for 10 years. Basically, I was forced into therapy. I had my program and I had my 3 times a week with the doctor and everything. I was basically forced into therapy. But if you have agnosognosia, why would you take medication you don't think is necessary that makes you feel terrible? And why would you submit to talking to a doctor if you don't think there's anything wrong with you?
Right.
So agnosognosia really is like at the heart of the mental health dilemma, because if you can't understand, if you can't comprehend that there's something that you need help with, then why will you get help?
Yeah.
And it's even more frustrating for the families because they have to deal with the psychotic behavior that their loved one is showing because they're in agnosognosia.
Right. That sounds similar to something on a much smaller level to what I was dealing with about 10 years ago or so, because one of my previous employers was convinced that I had ADHD. Based on some different things that she was kind of picking up during the time that I was working with her. And she even had me speak with a counselor and just kind of, go through some things. And we went through some different exercises and everything, but eventually she wound up changing up since she was a senior minister at a church, she changed up the position so that it was no longer an administrative assistant and communication specialist. She changed it to minister for communication and membership, and basically made me no longer qualified for my own job because I'm not a minister. So out I went. And I had a couple other jobs during that time, but I kind of circled around back to that feeling of just like, maybe I do have ADHD. Maybe I've had it. And I just started kind of looking back at different things that I was going through, different things that I was having issues with and difficulties with. And then I started to really, you know, do a little more of a deep dive into it. And I was so convinced for years after that initial question of whether or not I had it, I was just like, no, I don't, no, I don't have it. You know, no, it's definitely not me. But then around 2021, that's when I kind of came around to it. And I was just like, maybe I should get myself checked out and just to see right. what's going on. And at that point, I was almost hoping that I did have it because of all the different things that I was kind of pinpointing throughout my years. So those were all different elements that I touched on in my interview with the doctor. But what I did not do was talk about a lot of different things that were happening to me when I was much younger, when I was 5, 6, 7, you know, around 8, around that time. And I didn't go into those times at all. But looking back on it, because the doctor, you know, like went ahead and said, no, you don't have it, because it would have manifested itself at an earlier age. Then I was just like, well, why didn't I bring up this, and this? Right. So now I'm at that gray area where like, I am kind of convinced that I have it now, but at the same time, it's still unofficially non-diagnosed. So right, it's right. like this weird kind of gray area there that I'm dealing with myself.
The thing about that is a self-diagnosis is always pretty dangerous.
And that's why I was like, just thinking like, maybe I should try one more time, speak with like a different doctor. And this time really, you know, go for like everything that I talked about that I should have talked about earlier, because those different things really, I think they probably would have helped with that diagnosis.
So I'm just curious, you know, this is just my curious Gemini mind, but what difference would it make to you knowing you had a ADHD diagnosis or not?
For me, it would just provide some sort of an answer right. because what the doctor concluded was that instead of having ADHD, I instead had what he called a computer virus in my head that was a mix of anxiety, depression, self-doubt, and fatigue. And all of that makes absolute perfect sense because that's all those four things I deal with on a daily basis. Right. So thankfully, I'm taking medication for the depression. And, you know, that's helped me out significantly, I would say. But there are some other things that I'm trying to work through, trying different things, different exercises, maybe right. even considering a meditation, just something to kind of calm the mind. Because, you know, like as of right now, it's been just like a constant feeling of overwhelm doing with all the different things that I do. This has actually been like podcasting has been my solace. This has been like my little sanctuary here because I have everything in a very good structure with this
right.
because this is just to pull back the curtain a little bit. This is the weekend before the first Tuesday of the month. So all of my interviews are done during that weekend. And that way I have all the time I need to edit each episode and get them ready for launch on that Tuesday. So right. It's helped in a big way. And funny enough, like when I tried to switch up the schedules recently, or if I would miss a day, it would mess with my head. So This routine has been very good to me. And I feel like the more routines I can adapt into everything else that I do, the better off I'll be.
Well, I agree with that completely because that's part of my mentoring for family caregivers is the importance of routine. And, you know, people say, well, what do you do? And I say, well, I help people communicate better with their loved ones. I help them understand the illness. I basically have experienced everything, you know, between my hospitalizations and everything. I basically experienced everything possible through schizophrenia except violence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other thing is that you know, this is where my reaction is everybody at this point, everybody wants a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody is like saying, well, what's my diagnosis? You know, how can I get help and everything?
Yeah.
And, you know, but the fact is that schizophrenia is not something that people want. You know, I mean, yeah. People say, I want schizophrenia. I wish I had schizophrenia. I wish I had heard voices. I've never heard voices or had hallucination in my life, by the way. But, you know, just this culture of illness where everybody feels they have to have something wrong with them, I think, is something that's really a part of the fabric of the unity of the nation and also the world, just because everybody wants to be sick. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm coming from the other way of I was sick. And I don't want to be sick anymore. I fought 50 years to get out of my sickness. And so, you know, I mean, that's just something that you sort of brought up in my mind when you were talking about being ADHD and, you know, the diagnosis and everything.
Yeah. And it sounds like with the 50 plus years that you've been dealing with, you've manifested quite a bit of insight for what others are dealing with. So this role of mentor is an ideal place for you, it sounds like.
Well, I want to emphasize that I'm not dealing with the patients.
No, you're dealing with the family members that are kind of like giving them what to expect.
And my main goal, this basically God downloaded me a system. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Live Love System, and it stands for learn, integrate, validate, explore, listen, observe, value, and express. And that's like the 8-step program I take people through.
Yeah.
But my goal really with family members isn't really to like make them more at ease with the illness. It's to help them reclaim their self-integrity from the pit of codependence and need that they feel towards taking care of their loved ones, often mm-hmm. to the detriment of other ones in their family.
Mm. Yeah.
So basically, I want to teach family members to be independent, to have self-integrity, and to be well themselves, because the better you are, the more you can help your loved one who's affected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I wish you all the best with everything that you're doing, everything you continue to do with the writing. It sounds like the writing has become something truly helpful for you as a person, as a creative. I am really excited to see you continue to grow in that field. And where can my listeners find you on social media?
Well, I'm on Instagram at Dale, D-A-L-E dot Walsh, W-A-L-S-H dot 14. That's my Instagram. And then my TikTok is Lord Dewgod, L-O-R-D-E-W-G-O-D.
Nice. So I am just so absolutely floored with everything that Dale has been able to provide as both personal insight, as a creative, as a mentor, everything that he is doing. And I hope that for those of you who have family members who are dealing with these issues, I hope that you are getting some form of guidance, some form of mentorship. And if not through Dale, then through someone else, but someone to kind of lead you through that path. And it definitely sounds like what Dale has been able to do with his own creative outputs is get himself through that as well. And I hope that those of you who, whatever is impeding your own creativity, I really hope that you're able to push through and just create some smaller works to get the juices flowing and then see where that goes. And just whatever you do, do not give up. Keep moving forward. If you have to pivot to a different genre, then by all means do so. But do not quit on yourself, because in these times, the world needs your voices, the world needs your stories, the world needs your ideas. Now more than ever. So for Dale Walsh, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.